Good morning on Tuesday, February 5th, 2013. You're listening to Brian and Gabe Live. I'm Brian Madden from San Francisco.
Also, and this is Gabe in Omaha, but if you sound out of breath. Did you just run into the studio?
Yes, I did. Hang on a second. Jack, cover for me.
That's not weird. It's our first show of 2013.
Yeah. And I will use this opportunity
on time for February 5th
to say that the people at TechTarget do not know how to utilize the free busy functionality on Exchange. So despite having this show booked, probably the only thing in my calendar – well, maybe that's it. Maybe I don't have used my calendar enough, but I just came right from a meeting into here.
The show is booked every Tuesday from now until the end of time.
Yeah. Okay. This is show number 42. And a lot of you know that 42 has a special place. Like, it is the answer to the universe from the Douglas
Adams.
Oh, it's
not funny if you have to explain it.
Listen.
Not everybody has seen that movie or read that book.
Yeah.
Like this guy.
Right. Now, 40 people know that 42 is a geek thing. Check this out, though. The Wikipedia entry for 42 shows there's so much interesting stuff on the number 42. Like, for example, if you have 20 – if you have a cube – like a Rubik's Cube with 27 squares in it, and you just number those from 1 to 27, you can create a magic cube where every number, every row, every quarter, every diagonal that goes through the center, the values will equal 42.
This sounds like some sort of numerology bullshit, though, where you could find that similarity in
anything.
Oh,
yeah? Check it. It's also the atomic number of molybdenum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which has 42 syllables.
It's the angle of a rainbow, man. Interestingly, here's the best thing about 42. It is – so theoretically, the fastest way to travel from one side of the world to the other side is a hole through the Earth. And so if you go right through the center of the Earth, you're going to accelerate thanks to gravity. And then as soon as you get on the other side of the center, you're going to start decelerating thanks to gravity. And now obviously if you go right through the center, that's like a long, like 7,000-mile ride. But if you just want to go from like here to, New York or whatever, it's only probably a 3,000-mile ride because you're taking like a small little angle. And assuming that this could actually be possible with no friction and no air resistance and that kind of stuff, it would always take you 42 minutes. Because no matter how long your path was, because if you're going through the center, you're accelerating, you're going farther, but you're also accelerating a lot faster because there's a lot more gravity because you're going towards the center versus when you're on the edge, it's not as long and your angle is the gravity acceleration is not the same angle, but it's a lot shorter path. So we'll always take 42 minutes.
Huh.
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And we didn't even get into the magic number section. I'll drop that. But 42 is not just, Douglas Adams. It is a magical number.
Well, to be fair, if you look for the number 41, there's also a lot going on for it.
Wiki 43.
Television station in Cleveland, Ohio. Okay.
Yes. Next week, we'll talk about what a centered hexagonal number is.
Right. This week, brought to you by the number 42.
Yes. Also, next week, we'll learn about Hedra numbers. Anyway.
Actually, Thursday is our 43rd show.
That's it. Thursday's show is with Mocha 5.
Mocha 5 and Intel. Maybe they want to talk about bring some interesting number factoids.
Here's a number. How many companies can Intel sponsor now for our shows now that they're all being bought? That would be Mocha 5, right? Because Intel and Lenovo did everything. Intel and RingCube did everything. Like all these companies did everything. Speaking of Intel, did I get my package here, Jack, by the way?
No, you didn't.
Okay, so this is kind of cool. So as you know, I wrote an article a few weeks ago, and I don't know if you can pull that up, maybe – Jack can pop that in the chat, where I was questioning whether Intel-based devices would ever be as thin, light, and long-lasting as ARM-based devices. And so I wrote an article, 6 months ago, where I basically said good performance, small size / lightweight, and good battery, pick two. And that's like the fast, cheap, and easy pick too, kind of like the magic triangle thing. What I'm saying is, ARM processors and the OSs that run on ARM-based devices like iPads and iOS and that kind of stuff, those are designed from the ground up for today's mobile, portable, flexible world and everything. And Intel is making their processors, they're trying hard to make their processors lower and lower power, But part of the way that they do that is that they just the performance is cut. So the problem is, for example, if you look at Microsoft Surface Pro versus the Surface RT, you know, it's got an Intel processor in it versus a ARM-based processor. The Surface Pro, yeah, it runs real Windows applications, but it only has half the battery life of Surface RT. It costs more and it's heavier, so it's not like the same kind of I can run it forever like I can with an iPad or with the Surface RT. Now people from Intel say, oh, but Intel, we do have small light. Look at the Atom, like Z2760 or whatever, and it's super small and super light. I'm like, yeah, but now you look at the spec numbers, like the Passmark, and that's scoring like 1,000 on Passmark, whereas my laptop here, my MacBook Air, scores like 5,500. So, yeah, in order for Intel to be so thin and light, it's such a low-powered chip that you launch Word and it takes like 30 seconds for Word to run. And by the way, my feeling why this is a problem was because I think it's more of a Windows problem, just because Windows was designed for more horsepower and more flexibility and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so I wrote this article and saying I don't think Intel, like, they're kind of screwed. They hitched their wagon to Microsoft, or Gabe, what did you call this?
Instead of hitching their wagon, they just welded it to the frame.
Yeah, they welded, like, Intel put their business to Microsoft. Like, it's called Wintel for a reason, right? Intel put that to Microsoft. And with Windows not being like the super most popular thing that people want to run on these small, light, portable, always with you devices, that's a big problem for Intel. And I kind of said, so what does Intel do here? They're screwed. So anyway, so Intel emails me and says, hey, we believe that this Atom-based device, the Z2760, is small, thin, light, has 10-hour battery life, and runs Windows 8 Pro. He says, I've been using it as my main computer since December.
And they were probably like, come on, you're doing email and browsing, so what do you need all that power for that your MacBook Air has?
I do watch a lot of internet video.
Yeah, right, but you're the guy that's like, I can do this with a Chromebook.
I can have an iPad. Yeah, yeah.
If you look at how powerful my iPad is.
But that's a good point. So this guy's saying, I got Real Office on there. And again, I would love – well, Real Office is – that's a separate side conversation. But the point is, they're putting one in the mail for me. So I've got an iPad. He gave me a choice, and I went with the ThinkPad brand because that's what I remember back when I used Windows-based machines. So I've got a Lenovo ThinkPad Tablet 2 on its way, and so that's cool. I mean, like, so I'm excited. I don't have it yet, but I told him that my whole life, I said this a while ago, even though I'm a Mac user, I don't really need the Mac. Like, my apps are Chrome, like Google apps, iTunes, Evernote.
What was that you said the other day about Outlook?
I use Outlook now. Wait, well, that's a whole separate...
Were you just setting him up to knock him out of the park there, or what?
No, this is... Well, that's a separate thing. So, cue the anti-Microsoft. No, hey, I love Microsoft. Well, no, I don't love Microsoft. All right, you got me, Flippy. No, but anyway, So I learned yesterday, Google – for some reason, I don't know if it's our version of Exchange or whatever, but the calendaring in the built-in mail app and calendar app from Mac doesn't really play well with our Exchange server. Whether it's all of them or not, I don't know. Like, even when I accept a meeting, it still says only tentative and stuff like that.
Well, and changes. Changes were my problem. So I tried to roll that way for a long time back when we first got with TechTarget. And it just didn't – it worked fine. The email part was fine. It was the calendaring that sucked, and it was updates, especially when there were updates. I'd end up with two appointments, and I didn't know which one was the real one and which one wasn't. It was just – I mean, you just can't beat Outlook when it comes to Exchange.
Yeah, so I put Outlook on my two computers, I think, Friday. And then yesterday – I get some Word documents that have some markup on it. I didn't realize this. I've been working in Google Docs for such a long time, and when I get Word docs, I can use Preview or import them into Google Docs or whatever. But Google Docs does not support importing comments from Word docs. So if someone emails you a Word doc file that's got all the comments on it, like, check out the comments. I emailed it to Jack, and I said, can you open this in Word and then send me screenshots?
just give it 6 months.
Well, hopefully. But in the meantime, I did actually...
F-U-I-T.
In the meantime, I did actually install the full Office suite. Because I do have things that have pivot tables also, like in our TechTarget revenue spreadsheets and stuff like that. Those are all pivot tables. And so yeah, I'm back. All right. I eat it. Like, I'm back on Microsoft Office on my platforms. So hopefully next year we get a new version of Office for Mac. And
so back
and
to the Intel.
Good for you for stepping up, though.
You know, good for me, Gabe. Yeah, good. Thank you
for admitting that. Because I mean, let's face it. There might be situations in the past where you'd stick to your guns here, despite the fact that it wasn't the best way to go. Actually, I would just argue the last year was you sticking to your guns, despite the fact that office was the best way to go. But you finally succumbed. So
yeah, that is.
But this is the problem that real organizations have, though, too. This is the reason that we don't see companies moving en masse to Google Docs. But it's the same exact reason that people didn't move to what the hell was it, Star Office, back in the 90s, Open Office, and things like that. It's not that the problem is strictly that it's not Microsoft. It's not Office.
But why
would Microsoft release iOS versions then? Because now, right now, they're like, okay, well, you need Office and you need Windows to run Office. So why would we release an iOS one that'll let you use it on a different OS? Let's make you do this on Windows, and that way you have to buy Windows too.
Hey, but we've been dealing with that pain of not having real Office on iOS, like. We've been dealing with that for 6 years now, and for 3 years now of editing documents on an iPad without real Office. So, like, is that really going to?
But who's we?
Exactly.
Because we is you, not
we
all the other
the
companies.
User. We is Jack. We is not Goldman Sachs 90,000 employees.
Right.
Because this is so here. Okay, so the article I wrote about my tirade against Windows. RT. Check this out. The link that is posted. This is a list of this is the Office RT feature list, and I can't link the fourth down FAQ. What regular features of regular x86 Office are not available on Office RT? And look at this huge list. It's so long. And this is, I got in a little web fight with Claudio because he made a blog post and said these are the exact full version of Office, and I'm like, no, it's not the exact full version. My point is with this is that if Microsoft can't make Office on ARM, like Office running on Windows on ARM, they can't make that have like air quote 100% functional compatibility with like real Office on x86, then there's no chance you're going to be able to do that also like on a non-Windows OS on ARM, like iOS and Android. And that gets back to Gabe's point. So the thing is, even what I was saying before when I was mentioning Google Docs, like Jack, you said, oh, give it 6 months. The list of things that Google Docs doesn't support, it might all be minor things, but the problem is if I have to support 50,000 Office users, then I'm like, this dude needs to import comments. This dude needs pivot tables. This dude needs like anchoring of pictures. This dude needs that. This dude, you know what I mean? Like eventually it's like, you know what, man? x86 Office is the way to go. And that's exactly why Microsoft is going to sell another, 200 million copies of x86 Office. Because it's the same on the web versions too. So they've got Word for web and Excel for web. I don't know if have you guys used that yet.
I have not spent much time in there. That's one thing I've been curious about. I use Google Docs every day for all of my writing. Is Office 365 web apps, are they that cool?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Do they require IE?
Nope, because I've been using them on Chrome or wait a minute, what did I use them on?
You don't have a VM, I don't think.
I think I do on my home computer. And I wonder if it was on the Windows RT. Office 365. I wonder if I can figure out.
Are nicely integrated into the Windows 8 phone.
From the quick using it, I mean, it was better than Google Docs because it was more Office-like than Google Docs. It looked like the regular version of Office. Like if you use Outlook Web Access from IE, I mean, you can't tell it's not Outlook. You got drag and drop and all that stuff. Now, I don't remember what I was using these. Office365.com.
So I'll be honest. I've had a few inclinations over the past year or so to sign up for that and test it out. So I sign up for Office 365. I get a trial. I use a different email address, whatever. And then I get to the screen where I can, add users to it. And I try that. I've even added you guys, I think, in the past. But then from there, I don't know what to do. I mean, yeah, okay, I can connect Office to it, but I have to use Office on Windows, and so that kind of sucks because the Office for Mac that I have does not seem to have Office 365 connectivity, but I can't find the web apps. So now, to be fair, I haven't looked that hard, but it was not as in-your-face as I hoped it would be to just run through a quick test. So If you have an account for that, I would love to see it.
I'm curious. So Brian's saying that like that's so Dan's saying that Word Web Apps work fine in Chrome. Brian says no one needs pivot tables. I don't know. Like that's the whole thing though. Like I don't know. I need pivot tables. Like all the tech target revenue stuff that comes out that we have to look at each week is full of pivot tables. So maybe that's just a weird tech target thing. But I would think that.
We had that in my last real job. We had that unless pivot tables went out of vogue and now there's some new.
My
kind
sister
of thing.
Uses pivot tables. She does consumer packaged goods category management and she's all pivot tables. But the thing
that's something that's a challenge that we have kind of because what we do, what we work for our company, but we're still kind of just our own. You know, we still have tech target IT, but a lot of the stuff we do ourselves and we source ourselves and that kind of thing. So we get kind of wrapped up in how we do business. But we, you know, keeping in mind, like to Jack's point earlier, we have to keep in mind that the companies do things in a lot of different ways. And there's different ways within a company, too. And that's what you were saying, like Goldman with 90,000 people. They've just got to have the thing that works for everyone. They don't want to have five different solutions around the environment and have to worry about compatibility between that. And that's where we get pivot tables. That's, you know, that's the problem that you're having, the comments and all of that. And that's why Microsoft and Office is still – that's why Office is still going to be a billion-dollar business for Microsoft for the, you know, years to come.
Yeah, and it's cool because that's why – I mean, and this is where the consumerization is kind of nice because – and this is exactly what we've done with TechTarget. Like if individual users want to figure out how to do something else and want to use an Office-like suite on iPad or whatever, then go for it. But when they need to actually use the functionality that – when then they need to actually access the corporate stuff, they have to jump through the corporate hoops, like regardless of whether they like it or not.
You know what's funny is I'm sitting here in a sense with a sense of smug satisfaction because I've always considered myself in that role, like advocate for actual things that are happening inside companies today, as opposed to wild ass sweeping declarations about how everybody should be using Google Docs and things like that. And I'm saying that because you've made those statements before, but there's lots of people out there that make those statements. And I've always kind of been like, no, it doesn't work that way. It would be nice if it did, but it doesn't work that way right now. So smug satisfaction Tuesday.
But this goes back to the power of the applications and the power of the enterprise application. And I was talking to, who was it? I was talking to – where was I in the last week? Was it, I don't know. I was talking to someone who didn't understand Windows apps. Was it
– Oh, you were here. That's what I – no, I'm kidding.
What the hell? Because the thing – like that's the thing. We like so underestimate how important actual – I mean like the Windows apps are or these existing enterprise apps. You know, like it's not so easy to just, you know – turn on a dime when you want to go to the next thing, and even if it's a little bit different, which frankly is the same reason that I argue against Windows 8 with the Tile World stuff, because it's the way everything works, the way people are used to working. You know, dropping a new environment on tens of thousands of users is very, very disruptive. So it's the apps. It's the apps that are leading. Like the OS is just.
Well, that's what Tim's saying. BYOA. I'm certain for Tim that's BYO. Bring your own app.
Yeah,
and that's just it. So, and Tim has been saying for years now that it's about the applications, but more importantly, it's about the data. So, if you can access the data, if you can use the data the same way for no matter what the application is, then we've solved the problem, right? We only care about our data, but the fact of the matter is that we still need the apps because the data is incompatible with all the applications out there. And actually, Jack and I had a pretty lengthy conversation about that with regards to his book that he's writing. In terms of what's the actual end game that we all care about? And it has something to do with that, but we weren't able to quite figure it out.
What is this?
Do you hear my dog barking, by the way?
I absolutely do. Yeah. That dog, any dog under 20 pounds should not be allowed to be called a dog.
Oh, believe me, that dog weighs more than 20 pounds. it's a pug, but it's a fat one. And dense.
Its head is smaller than its torso, which just looks weird. It's a chode.
You just learned that word.
I know. I was excited to use it. So, Jack, your book, The End Game, The Managing Apps.
The End Game. That was the idea that we were coming at was that I'm getting some sort of ringing in my headphones here. Maybe it's inside of my head. The end game that we were coming at is that this idea of mobile application management, you're still trying to specify what apps your users use to access certain information, and is that a problem, or will it be less of a problem as more and more data is intrinsically tied to the applications that are used to access it? Like that article that you wrote, was that December? Like, you know, what are files? It's all just integrated into apps.
Yeah, yeah. Or in the future of files. Yeah, like what's a file anymore? Right.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So it was this idea of, will we ever really get to a future where we can really just manage data without the applications that go around it and be 100% application agnostic? Or will data be so intrinsically tied into applications that by managing applications, they're a proxy for managing data?
You know, that's really fascinating, because the whole vision of like people who talk about the future of applications is all it's like connectedness and like openness and open exchange and standards and protocols and XML and all this kind of stuff to make it so your data is portable and stuff, all that kind of stuff. But what you're saying is almost the opposite of that. Like, ironically, the file was the most open, portable, you know, unit that you could open with multiple applications. And now that if files disappear, then so too did our ability to, like, there's no open in with, you know, Evernote, for example, you know?
Well, there is.
But no, what I'm saying is, like, your notes, like, how do I get, like, say, like, instead of, so my Evernote here, I got it right here. I got recent notes, all my different categories, all my notes. I've got sharing different things. If I just decide I want to view all this now, not in Evernote, like, yeah, I can export it back to a file. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't get this rich experience without that. So you're right. Like, if I want the rich, full experience of Evernote, I'm using the Evernote client, whether it's the web page or an iOS app or whatever. But I'm using the Evernote client. So in that sense, it's, yeah, as these apps and data get tied more together, then we sort of lose the ability to manage. Like I agree with what you're saying. Managing the app is managing the data.
And we both turned over to the screen to read the comments right now. Brian says you can't be 100% agnostic, but MIM means you have an API SDK that allows you to be that way.
Yeah, but MIM is depending on files, which I wonder what the long-term... What's the lifespan of a file? You know, that's going back to the article I did in December where I was saying, you know, like files are going away. And it's actually kind of true. Like if you look at my Dropbox, we don't use Dropbox nearly as much as we did when we first started using it, you know, 5 years ago. Because now it is, I mean, so much
you will now that you have Office.
No. I'm still using Google Office for everything. The only reason I installed Office is so if someone sends me something and I need the actual stuff.
Well, and that's the thing, and the way that we use Dropbox for the most part is our file names are tags, so yeah, that we can search them easier. You know, like I gotta find the file that's about, you know, the VDI Roadshow handbook or something like that. You know, so although we could use Spotlight for that because it would find stuff inside documents. So, but you're right, the way that we're using that changes quite a bit. We're not coding file names to fit in some sort of taxonomy. We're just tagging them.
But I mean, even look at the files themselves. Like what do I use Dropbox for? If I just serve it backwards, I've got...
We use it to share files between us. That's our network share.
Right. But my point is what we're not using Dropbox hardly. Because remember, everything we did before is all Word documents, and now it's all in Google Docs. And even we moved, like Gabe yesterday, we had a Word doc that we, from like a year ago, we hadn't touched. And of course, the first thing we did is moved it into Google Docs. So now there's one more down, like one more file down. Like, I mean, we use Dropbox for...
you know what, though? But we only moved it there so we could work on it together. I'm going to have to move it back out again to actually deliver that to the people that need that document.
Right, but you're not going to store that document in Dropbox. Like, you're going to use it, you're going to download as docx from Google Docs and then send that off to Jackie. But the master copy is still this copy that's up there in Google.
Yeah.
So we're getting a bit futurish feeling right now.
What's your point though about Jack? You were talking about is managing apps a proxy for managing data?
Right now, in many cases, I feel like it is. When we're when we're looking at the current state of available technology right now.
Is that an article, by the way? Have you written that article specifically?
No, I haven't. It's on my list of articles to write.
I would say add it, yeah.
It's in the book.
It's in the book. He wrote a very long article about it.
It's in this giant article that's going to be coming out on April 1st.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
So looking at our other talking points of things that have happened recently, let's see. I see on our list BlackBerry 10, Dell going private. We can talk about VMware.
That was the joke going into this. So we were just bullshitting before the call. Like, all right, welcome to hour number 7 of our ongoing Dell going private coverage.
I feel like the BlackBerry 10 coverage has been beaten to death.
I feel like we talked about that. Maybe it was just us. I guess we didn't talk about it. We haven't done a show in a while. But
Jack did a show on that.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, we talked about that. There's not too much to add to that conversation.
Okay.
Did you see it for the Dell going private thing? So last week we were talking about maybe Microsoft would be chipping in $1 billion, like $2 billion from Microsoft.
Yeah.
As a loan. Is all this stuff structured as a loan?
We need Kevin Goodman.
I'm asking you. Yeah.
Hey, Justin, get Kevin on the phone. Is that a thing? Can you even do that? I don't know, because I know like they don't have. Yeah, I don't know. I'm uneducated here, so we need someone who actually knows what the hell they're talking about to come educate us. Because I know that they don't raise enough money, so the $24 billion is like the price basically cost to buy back all the shares that are out there. But they get loans. Because I know the actual cash going in is not enough. Like they didn't raise like $24 billion in cash necessarily. They raised some cash and then they get some loans. And I don't know what the terms of loans are. I guess they're pretty good. Like this is what happened in the 1980s. You know, when all these companies went, like you talk about like corporate raiders and all that kind of stuff, and like the Predators Ball, which is this party. Like there's like the junk bond industry, which is like these are these bonds for these companies that have ratings of junk. So like every company's got a credit rating, you know, and they say that, oh, like these companies that have like tons of debt have bad credit. And anyway, it's like that, right? And so I don't know, like there's so many stories of companies like this where they go, they're taken private and then they like break them up and sell the assets and then the company goes bankrupt. Now in this case, it's maybe not the case because Michael Dell was like at the helm and stole it there. And it was not a hostile takeover or anything like that.
Plus they need money to operate after the fact. So if they're not gonna spend all their money on acquiring back the company to have nothing, you know, to operate with.
Yeah.
My uncle bought a gas station one time and only got the money to buy the gas station, but forgot to get money to actually buy gas. And so he owned a gas station with no gas until he got a loan from like my grandfather or something to buy gas that he paid back in very small increments over like 30 years. Maybe this is what that is too. Maybe this is money, like, you know, cash on hand kind of stuff, as opposed to money to help buy back the company. I don't know. I'm talking out of my ass, but it's interesting to see how this is all shaking out because it's a big deal. Microsoft is putting money into a hardware company and further disrupting their ecosystem as it's existed for the past 20 years.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, so obviously what we can talk about that is relevant to us is you know, people are saying that now Dell can do what they need to do without the scrutiny of quarterly number reporting and revenue and everyone. Which, I mean, we had that at TechTarget. We're a publicly traded company, and you know, like every single, you know, on week 12 of every quarter, we get the email from our COO like, "Come on, guys, push it in, get the deals closed." And like it was like that when I was at HP. It's like that everywhere, you know. And so it's just really shitty. So this would be nice to not have like that kind of scrutiny. But then the scrutiny is only like whether Dell can actually pull it off, you know, being successful in this environment now that they're in is not related to whether they're public or not. Like I can understand that being public gives a certain pressure, but being private, like you still need a plan, you know, like you still need to convince people to like, give you billions and billions of dollars a year. And that's
because you can be a lot more relaxed while you're doing it.
Right, like as the wheels are falling off, you don't have to tell people the wheels are falling off.
You don't have to write down everything that happens.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. The Microsoft thing, like, so Microsoft, remember they put $1 billion into Nokia, and then all of a sudden Nokia was like only making
Windows phones.
Although even Nokia I saw was like maybe talking about doing something else with, I don't know, Android or whatever. But I wonder if that's the thing with Dell. Like, I mean, I guess, I don't know. Does Dell still make, I don't know if that just means that just kind of locks them in or gives Microsoft.
I mean, you could have bought stuff from Dell that had ESX preloaded or Linux or things like that. But I mean, Dell always seemed to be kind of, you know, hitched up to Microsoft already. So I think that Microsoft would get involved if they were trying to, maybe they're just trying to save Dell. You know, maybe they're just trying to, like, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's get control of this thing back. But, you know, the fact that they're also creating their own hardware, their own tablets, that kind of a thing, I feel like, you know, if they had a little bit of a dog in a fight, so to speak, that would be good for them too. So maybe or that they would think that was good for them. So we'll see what happens. I mean, hell, $2 billion, that's, you know, just a little bit more than what they've spent on marketing. So, you know,
yeah, for Windows 8, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so who knows what the development and you know, all the other back end costs are.
And $2 billion out of a $24 billion deal is not a big stake, right? Like, it's under 10%, and
yeah.
It says it's a loan, like the New York Times. So it's not like Microsoft bought Dell stock and it's like sitting out and like now we'll own part of Dell. Like, it might be more like they just kicked in some money to sort of help along. But it's interesting too because it could purely be, I don't know how much cash Microsoft has. I think it's a lot, and these people with this cash have to do things with it. And so let's say Dell gives them, you know, the existing safe bets for Microsoft's cash is only going to be 1 or 2% interest. So if Dell gives them like 5%, then it could be just an accounting decision at Microsoft. Like, yeah, this is where the accountants are going to park some cash for 10 years or something.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point too. Well, anyway, we'll see how that shakes out.
But I do
look forward to less information from Dell going forward, though.
yeah, it's crazy too. I mean, I don't know. You know, we talked about Dell. Like, we talked about Dell. Or Jack wrote about, you know, they've got like four different MDM products now, because Quest had bought an MDM company. So Quest had, and then Dell had bought an MDM company, and there was Case, and then they bought Wyze, which is making an MDM product. And there's all these different MDM products, and they all work differently, and they're all not compatible. Like, some are cloud based, some are on premises based,
I'm sure that duplication exists for dozens and dozens of other products.
Yeah.
This is just the example that I'm close to.
It'll be interesting, though, to see, like, it's funny, too, because Wyze wanted so badly to go public for such a long time, and then they got bought by Dell, so they were public for, like, 20 minutes. although, I guess all of them, they got probably taken care of. And frankly, you know, probably the deal was all these people had options at Wyze, if they were given options, for example. I'm sure they all vested.
It's probably worked out better.
Yeah, because now they don't have to stay there for 3 years.
Either that, I mean, that maybe they knew about that ahead of time too, because I can't imagine they decided to do this last month and then made it happen in 30
days. It says August, actually. Which, when did the Wyze thing happen?
July?
Yeah. June? So, yeah, it said that August, Michael Dell came to the board and with this idea. But yeah, crazy. So, but it's crazy. We feel like a whole industry now. I mean, okay, so we had, in the old days, it was like IBM, Dell, Compaq, HP, right? And IBM, obviously, on the consumer side, went to Lenovo. On the server side, I don't know, do they still make IBM servers? I guess they do. I mean, it always seems like
Dell. I think so, but I think they're IBM branded, like they're actual IBM.
Yeah. But always, yeah. It seems like Dell and HP, and obviously UCS is getting, you know, Cisco UCS is kind of getting into the server space now. But, you know, HP... So, because HP is just sort of imploding right now, and they have all the deals, like, with the autonomy and the write-offs, and people are leaving there, and they didn't have a tablet product this Christmas, and HP just seems to be just a giant disaster.
If they would have had a tablet product, don't you think that would have been a waste of money? I mean, because they would have put all sorts of R&D into it. They would have put, you know, all the manufacturing, all that stuff, to actually create a tablet, then to market it, then to have it, what, come in sixth?
I mean, well, that's true.
But what's the best case scenario? I mean, they're not going to make something that's going to kill an Android or an iPad. So what's their best case scenario? And their best case scenario is behind the Kindle Fire, behind Samsungs, behind Nexuses, behind iPads, behind iPad Minis. I mean, it probably would have been a waste of money to do that. Maybe that was a good idea, is what I'm suggesting.
No, you're right. Yeah, I guess that's a good point. And you know, this is Gabe. Nice job applying critical thinking. As I was parroting what I read TechCrunch or something.
Suck it, high school teachers.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, but I don't know. So it's just it's crazy, man. Like it's such a different world now, and you know. So now we're on. Come on, what is this? This is year 17 for me in the industry. Gabe, what's this year 16 for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's yeah,
and it's I don't know. I mean, it's I feel like shit's different now. And now, especially also like that thing from Aaron Levy, who's the CEO of Box, that I posted something he wrote, I think, in December, where he was talking about even like enterprise software is coming out of startups now. And because before, like all the startups, it seemed like all the cool startup companies here in San Francisco were all like consumer type companies.
Yeah.
And now, do you see a company like Tomfoolery, which, by the way, I tried to reach out to them and I failed. So I don't have any contacts like in the startup space, unfortunately. And so these people, like these five people, come together and they're trying to make sort of like enterprise grade, like consumer ish type startup apps, but like enterprise grade, right? So because a lot of times the problems we have in the sort of startup world is there's all these apps that users and consumers love, but they're like consumer grade applications, so they don't have all this. You know, certification and delegated administration and auditing and all the kind of stuff that you need, like an actual corporate app. So there's a whole new sort of renaissance of these companies that are starting, like all the startups making actual applications designed for the corporate world. And these are all obviously like non-Windows applications. We're also seeing Windows apps and web apps, you know, kind of coming together. So like web apps, we talk about, you know, Google Apps is all. You know, was all web-based, and now they're building client versions, and it can run offline, and they've got, you know, iOS and Android versions of QuickOffice, and then other existing Windows apps are becoming web-enabled, so now Office 2013 is all, has, you know, you save everything into SkyDrive, and it's all got the collaboration built in, and you can still have the same collaboration and multiple people editing the document at the same time with chatting. You can have that locally on your copy of Word.exe on your laptop, as well as a version on the web, or you can have some of each. It's just... I don't know. I just feel like it's really – it just kind of hit me when I was sort of reflecting on the year and, like, what's going on ahead that, like, I feel like stuff is, like, really, really different now. And I don't know if it's just – it's like boiling a frog and it's been getting different slowly and I just never noticed it all this time and I just finally opened my eyes back to look. But I feel like right now the world we're in with enterprise IT is, like
– Well, we're getting older too and crotchety, you know, set in our ways. And so – You know, you look at something that you've been doing for a very long time, and you're like, oh, shit, there's this new way to do it, but this is different. You know, so there's some of that. I feel like that we're more nimble. You know, we're where we are in the industry, kind of keeping eyes on these things. But still, like, you know, when you step back and look at it, you're right. Things are definitely different. But I wonder what people in our position 10 years ago thought, you know, because I would think that they would think that shit was pretty different then, too.
Right, and we were talking about... I guess that's true because, like, they would have seen, like, laptops coming on. So, Gabe, like, you and I, our first jobs, my first couple of jobs, I didn't have a laptop. But then I think it was a Vanstar.
The little compact Armada, the white thing.
5280.
Yeah, that was
Let's
it.
Let's find this. I think it was LTE 5080. 5280.
It was LTE. I was happy to get a professional laptop.
I'm taking notes about what I'm going to... Put in the show post when we post the recording. And
this is the laptop that they gave us at. This is the laptop that they gave us.
Oh my God! Look at that thing.
The note that I'm going to insert will be something along the lines of like Brian and Gabe are old and crotchety, comma reminisce about days.
Okay, so the thing is with this, remember there was no built-in networking card or built-in modem, and there's a 2PC MCIA as they were called back then slots. The plastic door on back to look how big the bezel is, but this thing. So the point is though is yeah you're right because maybe it is because as soon as you got laptops now that meant that you had to deal with dial in you had to deal with modems you had to deal with
none of that shit worked with NT5 that we put on it.
Oh, yeah. NT5 blue screened that thing for me. I remember that. I got those discs from Chuck. What was Chuck's name?
Chuck Russo.
Chuck Russo? Chuck Russo. If you're out there, man, thanks for the NT5 floppy disks. It was like a stack of 30 of them. But I don't know. It's crazy. It makes me excited, though, because like I said, and I said this in the post, that I always worked in enterprise IT, which I never thought was cool before. But I'm kind of wondering if we can parlay what we're doing now into something that's like legitimately cool. Because I feel like there was like the cool technology, and those are like people from like, you know, CNET, and they talk about, and like TechCrunch, and they talk about like cool stuff. And then there's what we do in enterprise IT, and it's like Citrix and Windows. Just like, because, you know, it's IT, not tech, right?
I feel like, you know, the people that we talked to today that were like, yeah, whatever, convince us of your technology, are, you know, they're the same people that we dealt with 15 years ago when we're going in with, you know, MetaFrame, and they're like, yeah, I don't get it, convince me. You know, they it's that cynical look, and then so they get the same thrill that we used to get when you see in somebody's face that, you know, we get it. So I think our places in the industry have just switched a little bit with age and exposure. We're cynical now.
So what next, do you think?
I don't know. So on that, though, to recognize that that's happening, I think is important. So as long as we, you know, keep an open mind with that, I don't think that we'll be too screwed over by it. But yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it definitely is different. But we also get the value of all that experience, kind of figuring out how things fit into the world. And then we get to make fun of the cyclical nature of things, too. Like, all of a sudden, now we're talking about everybody having their own device instead of storing it in the data center.
Now we got to get – so, Jack, we got to get you into an enterprise. So I offer up Jack as an intern for 1 month and just give him some enterprise IT job. It's got to be 50,000 seats or higher. We'll fly him there, and because a month is hardly enough, but, like – because that's the thing, because stuff is so different. And even for me, it's fading, because my last real work in an enterprise was now 10 years ago. And now we're doing, you know, we're still doing a lot of consulting and that kind of stuff. So we're sort of close to the enterprise, but it's like I'm there for a day and then I leave.
Yeah, so, and when's the last time you went on a raised floor with your bones cold because air was blowing up your pant leg? You know, it's been a while.
That's probably been since Tech Target, right? And before that, the raised floor, although nowadays I feel like the new data centers are all flat floors and like cables go ahead on top, right?
But who builds a new one?
Equinix. that was my last – it was all the Brian Madden servers, which is funny to think about too. That when we sold our company to TechTarget in 2008, we had like 20 servers. It was all physical servers that ran our company.
Oh, yeah. Those things weighed down my truck when I went to go finally get them and dispose of them.
I got to find those pictures. We've got pictures of those somewhere.
Okay, one last aside story. We used to have a Michelangelo, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, sitting on top of the servers, taking care of them, you know, protecting the servers. I found that the other day, and now that my son, Carson, likes Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I gave that to him, and he thinks that is just the best damn thing.
So talking about a cyclical, like, so even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is cyclical, and so we had Michelangelo guarding our servers, and now, you know, like...
Right. As is this conversation. So how about VMware restructuring and layoffs in the EUC group? What is Core? You know, what have you heard anything of what is Core or considered the Core focus groups for VMware?
Well, I can see how Slide Rocket is not Core, but Horizon would be Core.
Well, so I was talking with David Stafford about this, and I just sent him a text. I'm like, what the hell is Core? Like, what is the core of VMware's, you know, their group that we're focusing on? Now that Slide Rocket's gone, there's been a huge layoff at VMware. You know, so what actually is core for them? And currently, end user computing is part of their core focus. So now, who knows if that's going to remain that way? But right now, the way they talk about it, it sounds like EUC is still considered core. So this talk about EUC spinning off. I don't know if that's something that's going to happen immediately or not. It's still fun to talk about it, but as it stands, it seems that EUC is safe within VMware's walls. But I don't know. You know, there's all sorts of that kind of jockeying around that we see. So I don't know. Thoughts?
I mean, I guess that – so supposedly they're going to talk a lot about this at Partner Exchange also, because I've had a whole bunch of people there ask me if I'm going to Partner Exchange, which I was not aware that we were allowed to go since we're not partners. But yeah.
I mean, the idea of them spinning off – because so Kevin Goodman wrote an article about this after the whole Slide Rocket thing was announced. He also wrote an article about this last year, back in August, I think it was, about what if VMware would spin off the EUC group into, you know, Horizon View or whatever it was, where the Horizon components and the VMware View components would spin off into their own companies rather than VMware trying to do that. So to let VMware proper focus on virtualization, the data center virtualization and software-defined data center and things like that. And so it's just funny to see some of these things start to kind of indicate that might happen, despite the fact that, you know, the EUC group apparently is still part of the core. So I don't know. It's interesting to me. It seems like, you know, Jack wrote that article about VMware towards the end of last year, I think it was, with that awesome picture. What was the picture, though? I remember it was awesome.
It was the big truck tipped over. Oh, right. With a VMware label on it, with other cars
drove past, right?
Yeah, speeding around it.
Yeah, and so, you know, delivering on products like that. Hopefully, if VMware is restructuring or something to focus on something, hopefully that is on releasing products that they've talked about.
Well, that's the kind of thing because, yeah, like so obviously, I don't know what the hell they've been doing for the past 2 years.
Yeah,
hasn't been releasing products in the EUC group.
Exactly.
So if they've been like,
If they say it's core, does that mean that they're going to release some products now?
But also, does that – I mean, like, it doesn't – not spinning it off seems to not work. So wouldn't you want to spin it off then, because then you get some focus on it? I mean, I don't know what's going on.
Maybe,
I know Steve
maybe they're spread around. I mean, maybe they're too spread out. That's the thing. But – and, I think of all the times we come out of VMworld and we're like, holy shit, these people get it, you know? And then – they talk about all the awesome technology and we're like, man, when this comes out, this is going to rock. And we're still waiting on a lot of that stuff. And so maybe that's what all this restructuring gets me hopeful for, is that we can actually finally see some of these things.
But the EUC keynote this year or this past August at VMworld, it seemed sort of toned down a little bit in like, hey, the future is going to be awesome message.
You are correct. This year, I came away less enthused than in past years, but
because they enthused you last year, and then they didn't do shit in the intermediate months, you know. So they couldn't re-enthuse you again, because at some point you're just it's just a tease.
Fool me once, yeah.
I would have walked away. I would have walked away like super jazzed if they had been like, "We're releasing all of these products," which is what we were sort of hoping for after the entire rest of the industry spent the summer introducing and releasing like lots of EMM products.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you know, who is releasing products is Teradici, though, because now they've got their PC over IP remote desktop session host, you know, their terminal server based solution. So there is some stuff that we saw at VMworld that's coming out, but it's not from VMware, even though it's based on their stuff.
The Teradici thing is interesting, and you know, I met with NVIDIA a couple weeks ago also, and, you know, we wrote an article about what they were doing, I don't know, a year ago, with using GPUs to actually help with the encoding of, so putting GPUs in servers, virtualizing them at the hypervisor level, and this does two things. Number one, it provides a GPU, a virtualized GPU, to every single VM, so that way you can run applications that require GPUs, which is nice, but the real use case for this is just the fact that GPUs are so fast and they can like write sort of custom encoding mechanisms that can leverage the GPU to do the actual encoding of the remoting protocols. So it was actually NVIDIA who works with Microsoft, VMware, and Citrix to write the code that snaps into the hypervisor so that they can both, as I said, virtualize the GPU and as well as provide a GPU to the rendering pipeline for the for the protocol to send it down to the client.
And so is that out now? Because I talked to Justin Boitano from NVIDIA in October at Synergy in Barcelona, and there they were just talking about, you know, you can put this two-core card in, and then each core, you can dedicate a user to each core, and then that gets remoted. So it was, I mean, it's cool we get that added performance, but all of the other stuff that was utilizing that same card was not ready yet. So is that stuff ready now?
I have to go back and take a look at where everything is. NVIDIA is all done with it. It's just now that the vendors have to do it. And so, like, the software vendors. So, for example, if you want to use this – so, like, let's say you want to use a GPU to accelerate the encoding of HDX. So, mm-hmm. A, your hypervisor has to provide that, and then B, the VDA that snaps that plugs into each VM has to be updated to have that. So, for example, with Citrix, I think, like, you get that support if you're using the latest version of Zen Server and the latest VDA or something like that. But it's like there's certain combinations where it does and doesn't work. And I don't think Vue does that yet, although I know there's another Vue. What are they now, 5.1? I think 5.2 is around the corner. So that's – but the thing is the NVIDIA stuff and what they showed was – and the performance is really amazing because they have so much horsepower available in the GPUs. They can really do some hardcore encoding and compressing on the remote side so that the protocol is a lot lighter and the workload for the client to unpack it is a lot lighter. And so they're showing off like pretty legit, you know, like major, like super high resolution, like lots of pixels moving around, graphics and that kind of stuff over, you know, decent connections, not super fast connections, and they're saying like they believe that the whole compromise on experience, like it doesn't have to be from a graphical standpoint. We always look at VDI as not that great of an experience, and they believe 100% that they can deliver like an uncompromised experience over like the real internet, and but of course doing so requires you loading up GPUs into your servers, so. That's cool, though, that's coming along. It's also cool, by the way, that a lot of the, like, so many software so many storage vendors now are using, like, virtual appliances to like, make their, like, good storage solutions for VDI. So, like, Greenbytes is coming out with a virtual appliance in a few weeks. We saw Atlantis at, you know, with a diskless VDI, like, all this kind of stuff. And what's cool about those things is those don't require, like, Fusion I/O snapping cards or anything crazy. So it's like, frees up the slots. My point is like, if I got sort of a regular server, a blade with one slot, I can put some GPUs in there and actually get some decent performance and make VDI kind of be pretty good. So right. I'm trying to convince NVIDIA to come to Briarform to show off, like, in the demo lab, this actual stuff. Because the stuff that they showed me looks pretty great, and you wouldn't necessarily know that you're using VDI. And they have they're encoding so fast, they actually dump the rendered, encoded, ready to go stuff. They hand it off to the protocol handler, so they can hand it off to RemoteFX or to HDX faster than they can dump it out the DVI port in the back of a graphics card.
Wow,
which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's cool. What else do we have here? We've got 7 minutes or so here to go.
I guess maybe Jack is yawning like crazy. So I don't know, VDI is boring. We don't have to go a whole hour, I guess.
No, it's awesome.
Okay. What do you want to talk about, Jack?
Let's see. While we random stuff in the last couple of weeks. Gabe, how's that Android mini PC? What was that like? So you wrote about this and, you know, after the Wise Ophelia announcement, I've been curious about those Android mini PCs, and I don't think we've actually talked about this before, so we might as well now. Like, what's that thing like?
Well, I wrote an article based on because I bought one trying to just get an idea of the form factor and like, would I actually use this if it worked well? I didn't expect a $40 thing to work well, and I was not let down by that. It sucks.
You mean you were not let down in that the performers let you down?
Yes, I expected it to suck, and it did. It lived up to all of my expectations. So right now it just sits. The only thing cool about this thing is it has that rubberized kind of IBM ThinkPad kind of feel to it. But it's already wearing off despite the fact that it's only sat on my desk. So even that kind of sucks. This thing though, it's a paperweight. I cannot figure out how I would use this thing, in a hotel or even in an office as in the travel use case that Wise talked about. I just I just don't get it. When I talked to Wise, they were at CES, and they were saying that Ophelia, you know, it works with touchscreen TVs. And I'm like, what the hell hotel has a touchscreen TV? And they're like, oh, the Samsung here does. And I'm like, you're at CES. You know, they probably replace all the TVs in the hotel with Samsung touchscreen TVs. And so, of course, it works there. But every other roadside motel that people are going to use these things at is, you know, be lucky to have an HDMI port to hook the thing up to. So my challenge here is the use case. The device, I'm sure the device can be made to rock. I'm sure that, you know, it's a tablet without the screen. So putting the hardware into the device to make it do cool things is not impossible. But the use case for it, where am I actually going to plug this thing into? I'm going to plug it into a TV, and then how am I going to interact with it? Do I have to stand in front of the TV and touch it? Do I have to hook up a Bluetooth keyboard and go sit in the hotel bed and use it? There's so many things, and none of them are awesome. Yeah, and none of the use cases for this that I can see are practical. I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm just going to throw my Android mini PC or my Ophelia into my laptop bag and forget my laptop or my iPad or something like that. I mean, it just doesn't seem practical. So I'm hopeful that Wise doesn't screw the pooch on this one. I hope that they have some sort of awesome master plan that I have completely ignored. There's nowhere to go but up in terms of my expectations of this thing.
Well, what about, so, you know, there were a few articles over the last, I don't know, they're probably like a year or two old now, about Android thin clients in general, you know, ignoring all the usability issues and like this isn't going to be a travel device. Android thin clients, is it going to happen?
Brian and I both have written articles about this in the past. I mean, and it's been 2 or 3 years now probably since we started writing them. But I decided, after I looked at it a little bit more hardcore with this mini PC and the Wise announcement and things like that, I think I'm pretty much over that. The problem, the thing that we thought would be awesome about Android thin clients was that we would be able to use actual Android apps that do all sorts of cool things, and we'd be able to connect to our remote desktops and local browsers and all this stuff. And the fact of the matter is though, the apps that are being developed for Android are not meant to be used in that situation. They're meant to be used on tablets and phones. And so when you start throwing them on 1920 by 1080 monitors and trying to, you know, change the orientation so that it comes in a landscape mode instead of a portrait mode and things like that, these apps weren't made for that. Remote desktop applications, some of the ones that I tried on this mini PC were, you know, they were clearly made for phones. Even the interface didn't recognize a right mouse click, for instance. So there's a lot that would have to be done to make that work. But ultimately, you could do, even if the person who makes the device knocks it out of the park and does everything right, the applications are still going to be a problem because the application developers aren't writing for that platform. They're writing for the more popular ones, the tablets and the phones. I'm over Android thin clients.
Yeah, the other thing about Android thin clients that I liked about it was the idea that you could have a lot of your existing applications on this thin client that would be, you know, that you wouldn't have to like use Windows versions or like waste VDI resources or whatever. So if you could have like your local mail clients and your local, you know, Evernote and Dropbox and like all these doodads and stuff. But then the problem with that is that's putting state back on these things. And so that means like even if the state can be reinstalled easily, like I just log into the Android world with my thing and it puts my applications back on, like now it's, mm-hmm. Now for me to use it, there's a setup process. There's my state that's tied to that device. There's, if I don't use that device for 3 months, now it's got to connect back and like update all my stuff. And it just doesn't, I think I was thinking too much, like there's too much tying my user state to the device, which I don't really love that. Like
Wise's thing too was that, you know, now you can manage. So right now this $40 Android mini PC that I bought is basically unmanaged and you can use any sort of, you know, MDM or, I guess MAM too, assuming that it works with it. But you can use these mobile device management products that we talk about, and Wise is no less. You know, they talk about managing the Ophelia device with, what is it, Stratus?
Cloud Client Manager now.
Yeah. It doesn't change the fact that what Brian said is that now there's a state on this device, and you know we're kind of fans of the stateless at this point.
Okay.
So I'm over that now.
drop the stick in the mail to me.
It's not a stick.
Oh yeah. Drop the brick. That's the other thing. It's not a stick. It's about halfway between like There's the picture that I put in the article was it was a small like Kingston 16 gig USB thumb drive, this thin PC or mini PC, and then a can of Coke, and it is right in the middle of the two, in terms of size. It's massive. It's probably four regular USB sticks if you like arrange them in a grid. So, yep, yeah, you can have it, my friend. You can have it.
So,
go ahead.
I guess we. Our latest device trading around. So I've got the Surface RT tablet. Jack, you're done with your Windows phone, so I guess I'll take that from you now.
Yeah.
And try that out.
Maybe you're just our device bucket. We're just sending it all back to you.
Yeah. That's about it. Like, I guess we got to try BlackBerry 10 at some point. BlackBerry shunned us despite all the work we did with them and them telling us, like, asking us all these questions about how we can get the word out. They did not invite us to their launch, and we asked to go, and they're like, "Nah, man, sorry, tickets were hard to come by." And I'm like,
"Tickets?
Yeah, right." Well, you know, their new creative director Alicia Keys was there, and so, which I love that. Anyway, so I guess they're gonna send us a BlackBerry 10 at some point. I don't know.
They're not even out in the U.S. yet.
Yeah, it's so March, right?
They're out in the U.K. So if anybody in the U.K. is listening and wants to buy one on contract for $175 and send it to us, that would be great. Otherwise, I forget what they are. They were kind of spendy to just buy outright without a contract, although somebody in Canada was selling them.
Oh, they're on eBay for like thousands of dollars.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, let's hang up here. I'm going to go. We got another call in a few minutes. I'm going to add some pictures of our old data center to Facebook. Follow us on brianmadden.com if you're not already. And we'll connect back on Thursday when we got Mocha 5 to talk about whatever they're doing and their pivot from traditional Windows management into the sort of iOS and app management space.
Yeah, it's Mocha 5 and Intel, so it should be interesting.
All right, because Mocha 5, so that was my all this tirade on Intel was when I talked about them giving me this nice Atom-based device. It's Atom, and it doesn't have vPro. I got to ask Jesus about that, because everything that I've heard about from Intel, why Intel's awesome, is because, oh, you need vPro. But then when they're trying to compete on against ARM, they're like, oh, no, use Atom. It doesn't have vPro. So, what?
Yeah, good luck with that.
We'll find out on Thursday. All right, I'm out. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks for listening.